Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. I'll be your host tonight, along with my esteemed colleague, Nicholas Brousseau. Would you like to say hi, Nick?
I would. Hello, and happy holidays and break time for those who have it.
Happy holidays indeed. We're both calling from home, I believe. Tonight's show is about the LSAT, the Law School Admissions Test. And we're hoping that we've got some listeners who are thinking about taking it in February or possibly later down the road. We'd just like to discuss that and maybe take away some of the mystery surrounding it for any inexperienced listeners. Is there anything you'd like to say before we jump into the meat of the conversation, Nick?
Yeah, we both took it in October. So, I don't know, we're going to basically, go over that experience.
Pretty intense. And we'd really like to encourage callers tonight.
Yeah. Why don't you tell them the number, Mike, if you got it in front of you?
Sure. The guest call-in number is 1-646-727-3928, and we'll get to you as quick as we can. Any questions are good questions. I guess just to kick it off, when you take the LSAT, you're being scored against a pool of students taking it with you as well as students who've taken it in the past. I think we said some 150,000 students take the LSAT each year. Does that sound right to you, Nick?
Yeah, it's like 140,000, so yeah, but around there.
Okay, so you're being competitively scored in that range. You get somewhere between a 120 and a 180. The LSAT is scored a little bit different than a generic test, and I think the reason why is to sort of keep kids from grading themselves or to keep them from thinking, oh, you know, I got a 99, that's an A. The administrators of the LSAT, I believe that's the LSAC, aren't interested in these arbitrary grades like A, B, C, D. They're more interested in dividing the group into the higher performers versus the average performers versus below average performers. So they take your raw score for the test, which usually has about 100 questions. It's completely multiple choice. No penalty for wrong answers. And they convert your raw score, which is just a number right, into this grading scale they have from 120 to 180. Typically, for any given iteration of the test, there's usually four a year. Is that right? June, October, December, and February? Yep, there's four tests a year.
Yep.
You can sign up for any of the four tests. And the median score is usually right around a 151. That would be the average score or the 50th percentile. And, of course, most scores are supposed to fall within one standard deviation of that. 85% of scores will fall within one standard deviation of 150. After that, it kind of goes either way, but it makes a bell curve. It's designed to taper off towards the higher scores and the lower scores. To give you an example, a 158 is usually the 75th percentile, so it's only 8 points or 7 points over average. On the other hand, if you get a 163, you're up around the 90th percentile. So the number of students getting any particular score tapers off greatly the higher or lower you get. To give just another example of what I mean by that, let's say you were to score a 158 on the LSAT. Had you gotten one or two more questions right, the math falls such that you would have gotten a 159 or a 160. There's only one question right or wrong difference between a 158 or a 159, whereas between a 151 and a 152, you may have three or four questions that you would have had to have gotten right to advance to that next point up. Can you give them some idea what the LSAT means for admissions into law school, Nick?
Yeah, this is an unofficial stat, but a friend, Brittany Mouzarakis, said that 80% of what they base their decision on is the LSAT. I don't know how true that is, but basically the two biggest factors are your LSAT and your GPA, and your major as well. You know, if you have a really difficult major, it may be the case that, you know, the law school admissions, depending on the law school and what they're looking for, will look at that stuff. And, you know, it may help to actually talk to the admissions place before and see kind of, I don't know, what weight they put on things. And that may narrow what school you're looking into going into. Also, I'd like to say that the way that the LSAT is graded is also the way that law school final exams are done, at least from every law school that I've heard of, that there is some sort of bell curve. And so you're in competition against all the people that are at your law school. have you ever heard of a school, Mike, that doesn't do that?
I'm not aware of a school that doesn't curve in some way, which can be either good or bad. I mean, when you think about the LSAT, for example, it's not just curved against the group of students you're taking it with. It's curved against students that have taken that same test in the past, whether it be the June test or the October test or some other test. And it might be the case that, in regards to the LSAT, that no one scores over a 170, or it might be the case that everyone scores over a 155. I mean, both those things are possible. Usually in law school, that doesn't happen. Typically, you're only scored against the pool of students you are taking the class with. So it's a small difference. But other than that, it is a similar sort of grading scale.
All right. Well, do you think we should just go into kind of what the LSAT is and what's on it and stuff like that?
Sure. One more thing. You brought up admissions and described how, you know, the LSAT is a fairly hefty weight in whether or not you are admitted or whether or not you get a scholarship to law schools. I think that that is changing somewhat in the modern day. And as Nick said, most dean of admissions are willing to speak to you if you want to get into any specific school. Most of them sit by their phone day and night, and if you want to give them a call, they'll tell you usually exactly what they look at, exactly what kind of scores and GPAs they want to see. But I know the few that I've spoken to, the dean or director of admissions, have told me more and more that they're looking at things like participation in college, you know, whether you were in honor society, although I don't know if that one's as important, but what sorts of things you did in college, whether you were active or whether you only took classes and, you know, partied. They look at, you know, the quality, as Nick mentioned, of your schedule, the difficulty of the classes you've taken. Now, it might be the case that you can't get into Harvard unless you shoot a 175. But on the other hand, schools like perhaps Michigan State might weight much more heavily on your individual qualities rather than just your GPA or your score. Or it might be the case that's all they look at. But I'd like to be a little more optimistic than that. But, yeah, we can
right,
go ahead and
well, we
go ahead.
We met with the or he came and spoke at CMU, the director of admissions at Michigan State. And he gave us kind of what the inside of their admissions kind of looked like. And yeah, they do weigh more heavily on that. But he also said, you know, it depends on the school and kind of what what that admissions council is interested in. So it is, I don't know, I would imagine that it varies a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
It might be that some schools simply have a formula where they plug in your numbers and send you an automated email whether or not you've been accepted, and others have, you know, rigorous admissions committees where they look over every single application and determine, you know, based on your writing skills, how good of a shot you have.
Yeah, and I guess we should probably say this, is that there's four tiers of law schools. So the top, the top 100 are tier one, and then the 250s, below that, and then another 50, I think, of law schools, and it goes kind of down. Tier one's the best, and tier four, the lower scores. But yeah, so
sure. And those are usually ranked by, I mean, the rankings change depending on who is administering the law school rankings, but usually Associated Press or, you know, perhaps the American Bar Association, these sorts of organizations. And typically you expect to see the Ivy League schools in the top 100. I know Harvard's always at the top, Yale's always at the top, Michigan is always at the top. But there are some, you know, not-so-Ivy League schools as well, and some very good schools, like DePaul, I know, is in the top 100. Is there any other good schools that aren't quite so pretentious?
Well, and one that I think is pretty interesting, I actually went and sat in on a class at Northwestern in Chicago. And
sure.
Yeah, they actually only take 2% of their incoming class as undergrads, and they really look for people that have done stuff aside from the academic world, or at least have a master's or a postgraduate degree. So, I don't know. It was pretty interesting going to that school.
That is very interesting. More options for the people who have, you know, life experience, who are looking at law as like a second chance at a career, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure they're in the top 10 law schools. But, yeah, very cool.
Okay. Well, we'll just go ahead and break it down for you. The LSAT has four sections or four types of material you're tested over. They're logical reasoning. There's two sections of logical reasoning. That is typically if-then type statements, questions about whether or not an argument is good, questions about the strength of an argument, about premises. Can you give any other examples of things you might expect to see in the logical reasoning portion?
No, that pretty much breaks it down. There's examples online at LSAC, which is the Law School Admissions Council, their website, lsac.org. I'm pretty sure it's on our show resources page. So you can always go there and look and see what we're talking about. They do give examples in a practice LSAT.
Typically, the logical reasoning section is one that people pay great attention to because there are two sections of the test, both of which are scored, which means that approximately half of the total questions you're scored on will be logical reasoning type questions. So it's only logical to study that portion of the test. Another section is analytical reasoning.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to just say another thing on the logical reasoning. For me, that was the hardest section. Because you really have to shift your frame of reference very fast because you have three or four sentences that could be about anything and sometimes longer than that. And you have to read through all that and then identify the question, which, you know, changes what you're looking at. And some people read the question stem first before reading the stimulus to kind of understand what they're looking for when they're reading through it. That was the technique I had used. You should say, too, that 35 minutes for each section, and there's, for the logical reasoning, about 24 questions or 25.
Could even be 26.
Okay.
But since you brought it up, do you want to go ahead and break down what a stem is, what a stimulus is, what a prompt is?
I guess I can try here. I don't have an example in front of me. That probably would have been useful to just go through one. But in any case, the stimulus is the passage that you're reading, a paragraph, which could be talking about prehistoric Earth and how tectonic shift was, you know, caused these icebergs to move or something, you know, and you're thinking about then causation. And then they might ask you, okay, well, what role does, you know, this sentence play within the argument? And so that would be a role question. There's, I think, 11 different types of question stems. So you have the paragraph stimulus, then the question stem, which could be like a role question or a parallel reasoning question where they would ask, which argument in the options below, A, B, C, D, or E, most parallels the type of argument being used in the stimulus above. And so then you would have to go through and read through the different options and decide which one was the best. And I kind of used the 2 of 5 rule. As I would be reading through, I'd be definitely not, definitely not. And then there'd be two that I might have to sit there a little bit longer on and decide which one I was going to choose. And it seems like in the beginning, the questions are really easy. And then in the middle, it gets a little hairy. And then towards the end, I don't know, that was the trend, at least for me, in logical reasoning.
I think it's all over the place. It really depends on the specific variation of the test. But Nick brought up some really valuable information that we should probably cover. First of all, when he was talking about what you could expect to see in a stimulus, he was talking about like prehistoric Earth and tectonic shift. One of the basic premises of the LSAT is that you need no prior knowledge of factual data or history or, you know, some specific sort of education in order to do well on it. It doesn't test you over, I guess you'd say, knowledge. It tests more over critical thinking, ability to discern truth, this sort of thing. So the questions come from a great variety of topics, but generally speaking, being familiar with the topic doesn't necessarily help you. Perhaps in the reading comprehension section, which we haven't gotten to yet, but in the logical reasoning section, being familiar with the type of material. Very good. Yeah, the type of material the question is discussing doesn't necessarily do anything for you so much as understanding the mechanics of an argument or what functions as a counter-argument. Basically, just understanding logic, I think, is the most important part of the logical reasoning exam. But regardless, as Nick mentioned, there are always 5 answers to any given question, typically for a stimulus, which is about a paragraph long in the logical reasoning section, maybe five sentences, you'll have one or two or three questions from one stimulus. So you'll be asked to read some fact or perhaps something about global warming, then answer one to three questions about the paragraph you read, not about global warming necessarily, but about the specific paragraph you read. And then, as Nick mentioned, you have to move along very quickly to the next stimulus, which could be about something completely different. For example, it might be about harmonic dissonance in music. You know, it could be about all sorts of crazy topics. But you can usually guess that it's going to be something pretentious, because the writers of the LSAT are certainly pretentious. So any sort of highbrow, pretentious topic.
Yeah, and you should be aiming for about a minute, 15 seconds a question. So.
Right, given that you have 35 minutes. Right.
Yep.
Given that you have 35 minutes to complete each of the five sections of the test, you want to be a little over a minute, maybe a minute, 10 seconds per question. So that's the logical reasoning section. Logical reasoning sections, there are two of them. Analytical reasoning is what's referred to as logic games. To give you an example of a logic game, many people have played something like a logic game. You'll hear story problems about a group of brothers, and you'll be given information like John is taller than Mike, Mike is older than Scott, you know, Scott has black hair. And then given these little tidbits of information, you have to organize them into a structure of oldest to youngest, or maybe alphabetize their names or something like this. Except the difference between those types of problems, which most of us have done at some point in our life, whether in a math class or just for fun or in conversation, and the analytical reasoning or logic games portion of the LSAT, is that typically you can't solve an analytical reasoning question. You can answer questions about it. You can figure out, oh, perhaps Mike is the oldest son, but figuring out the entire order of sons might be impossible. I guess all I'm getting at is you're given information, but never complete information. There are maybe one or two questions a year in the LSAT where you can completely figure out the entire order of each member of the set or something like this. Typically, the information you'll be given is complete, and then you'll be asked to either extrapolate on that information. For example, they might give you a prompt such as, if this additional piece of information is true, how does that affect the order of the set? Or they might ask you, if X is not number 5, who could be number 5? So you're forced to work with incomplete information, which I think is quite tricky. Anything else you wanted to say about the analytical reasoning section, Nick?
Yeah, from what I've heard from people and what I imagine, I think that analytical reasoning is the thing that somebody could improve most upon, just because you can learn the format of the games and how to set them up. So you have a sketch, and it's like a master sketch, so you fill in all the information you can, and you have symbols that would, for example, there's different types of games too. We've kind of been talking about sequencing ones. There's also matching, where you'd be putting like houses together or something like that. But in like a sequencing, for example, if they're like Mike is in front of Nick, then you would have M and N in some sort of sequence. And I use little dots to say that it doesn't say that they're right next to each other. It doesn't say Nick is immediately in front of Mike. It just says Mike is behind Nick or something like that. And so you would draw your sketch to signify that and fill out the picture as much as you can. And because of this, if you get your sketches down pretty well and you have a kind of a format or an equation to do it, you can really fly through a game, and then maybe spend more time on a game that's more difficult.
Sure.
Yeah.
Nick is alluding to a test-taking strategy. Most test takers, if not all, there may be some who do well without it, but I think they'd be savants or sort of child geniuses. Most test takers feel the need to diagram the information they're given in some visual layout, usually in boxes or in a line or something like that. For a sequencing game, you might put in a line, sort of alphabetical order or numerical order, whereas a grouping or a matching game, you might put in boxes or something of that nature. The idea is it's almost always too much information to keep track of in your head. You have to write down what you're seeing in a sort of shorthand format. At least I found that extremely beneficial, and I know Nick is a master at diagramming these sort of analytical reasoning questions. So it's almost always necessary to learn how to sketch. And as Nick also mentioned, the LSAC only uses certain types of questions, and they have been highly detailed and cataloged over the years. Might be a bit premature to get into this, but I personally would recommend anyone who wants to take the test on buying an LSAT book. PowerScore has a great, Kaplan I think has a good one. There are any number of good LSAT books out there, but all of them will teach you a strategy for documenting or diagramming these analytical reasoning questions, as well as gives you information on the other sections as well. But also, as Nick mentioned, one interesting detail about the analytical reasoning section, it's the only section of the test that is completely objective. There is no subjectivity in this section whatsoever. There's no better answer. There's no slight degree of difference between answers. There is always a correct answer in the analytical reasoning section that can be found by proper diagramming. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yeah, I mean,
there's always a solution.
It's deductive reasoning. So it's almost it's mathematical rather than logical reasoning. It takes more abstraction. I don't know if it would be inductive reasoning, but I would argue that the logical reasoning section is somewhat inductive. But
sure.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I think every other section has some sort of assumption being made or some sort of, as Nick mentioned, in the logical reasoning section, there are very often two good answers and three that aren't so good. And a common test-taking strategy, which I also used, is to quickly determine, well, these two answers are the possible answers. And probably about 90% of the time, you can figure that out with good certainty that, okay, it's one of these two questions. And then the trick is, of course, to figure out which answer is wrong. After sort of laying out the five possible answers, you can determine almost immediately these two answers are possible answers, and then by process of elimination, figure out this answer is wrong. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Well,
and finally...
reading comp.
Go ahead.
Finally. I'll take it away. So reading comp, there's now, there used to be three sections, but now there's four call them sections. There's four stimuluses of reading comprehension. And it's usually about, I don't know how long, it would be hard to say exactly how long it is, but let's say four paragraphs of information, maybe five.
I would say that's about right, yeah.
And they come from, like, the natural sciences, the social sciences, law is one of them. There's a couple other different areas that they may the humanities is one. So there's a broad amount of information that you would have to be going through. And some of it, with the natural sciences, it would be like you're reading out of a medical journal, you know, and they'd be like, well, this hormone, vasopressin, you know, moves through in this way, and there's usually two different points of view talking about the stuff that's provided in the introduction. And then you answer about seven questions on the information that you read. I would say that you really have to practice speed reading. And I didn't start doing reading comp well because I normally read slow and I take my time. And I learned with reading comp that you have to practice speed reading because there's no way you're going to get through all the information. I think you have about 3 minutes to read is what I've been recommended. 3 minutes to read one of the stimuluses provided.
Right, and in my opinion, I could be wrong about this, I think reading comp is the section that is most sort of inherent and the least learnable, although all of them, I would argue, are learnable types of tests. But the reading comp, for me, was very similar to the sort of tests I'd taken in reading classes in middle school and grade school, just at a much more sophisticated level. And you may be asked questions like logical reasoning, what role does this specific sentence play in this entire essay? Or what is the argument being made or something like that. But they'll also ask you questions about a specific word. They might, and that's one of the spots where prior knowledge might help you. Although, how you would ever study for this, I have no idea, because as Nick mentioned, the writers of the test draw on so many different sources, there's no way to predict what topics they're going to use. I mean, they're very incredibly specific and sometimes abstract topics. But they might ask you, for example, out of context, what does the word verilisimilitude mean? And then you'll have to read the sentence around it and figure it out. But would you agree, Nick,
right,
that it has the most to do with sort of your natural reading ability and less about test-taking strategy?
Yeah, it's definitely based on the reading. I mean, the name really says it, reading comprehension, and they want you to read fast. And so, I think it does. But you can practice speed reading.
Sure.
Also, to ad lib, my stepdad was telling me today how he went to a listening seminar and he was taught how to listen to a lot of information that is being spewed out really fast. You know, some people can talk incredibly fast and it's really hard to follow. And he said there's a real, technique in listening. And that's the same thing with reading. I would say that it's learnable, that you can learn to read fast. You can learn to listen to stuff fast and keep up with it. It's just a matter of practicing it. It was just, going through it and, all right, I'm giving myself 3 minutes to read this and then, not even deal with the questions, just read it in 3 minutes and then go over the information in your head and see what you remember. And I don't know, that's what helped me out, but.
Absolutely.
Because I was not shooting well on reading comp for a while there and then it turned out to be my best section, so.
It's kind of interesting. We talk about shooting or having shot a score. We look at the test, Nick and I, having spent a lot of time preparing together or at least discussing our preparation together, we look at the score as something that can be gotten, not necessarily a reflection of our abilities or our own intelligence, although it is supposed to be a intelligence test or an aptitude test. We're both convinced it is a very learnable test. And I think that's an extremely defensible position from experts. There's also there's another section of the test that is a test section or an experimental section. I don't think we want to waste too much time on that, though. Really shouldn't worry about that too much. I mean, if you're already studying the other sections of the test, you'll understand that there is a fifth section which isn't scored and is just used to field new types of questions. I wouldn't worry about that too much. But anyway, in studying for the test, I think we'd both like to stress that it is a learnable test. The types of questions that are being asked, the types of strategies that work are extremely learnable through practice and through some supervision. Again, I'd recommend buying a good LSAT book, whether it's PowerScore or whatever, and reading through the information that's provided because, it's being written by incredibly intelligent people who have done nothing but study the LSAT. But for the logical reasoning section, you can learn to understand what you're being asked. Many times there'll be a red herring answer in the possible answers that, while it's true, has nothing to do with what you're being asked. In Nick's example, you could be asked a question about prehistoric Earth and the shifting of tectonic plates, and one of the answers might read something like, the Earth began shifting in 10,000 BC. Which, while that might be supported by the stimuli, it might have nothing to do with the question you're being asked, which says something like, how did the dinosaurs go extinct, or why did the dinosaurs become extinct? It has nothing to do with when the Earth began shifting. Anyway, that's something you can learn by studying the test and by practicing it. If we can just get on our soapbox for a minute here, I highly recommend anyone who's preparing for the LSAT, before they do anything else, as soon as you have this notion that you might want to be a lawyer, sit down and take an LSAT. You can find them anywhere. They're free all over the place. You can get them off the internet. You can buy books that have hundreds of them. Time yourself. Get yourself a little stopwatch. Put yourself through the time test and just take it, because there's no better way to explain what to expect than just trying it once. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yeah, I would agree with that. This would be my one proviso. I didn't take a practice LSAT, a full one, in its actuality until I'd been studying for it for about a month, because I didn't want to go into the test and get an idea in my head that, oh, this is what I shot. I wanted to have a familiarity with it before I was willing to see what I was going to get. In terms of my psychology, I felt that I didn't want to, set myself up to be like, oh man, I did really bad. This means that, you know, it would just put the possibility in my head that I wasn't going to be able to do well on it.
Sure. And
So,
if anyone's having that thought, just go ahead and like to stress again, I don't think anyone is a 150 or a 160, or anyone is only capable of a 150 or a 160. I really do think that anyone can improve on their initial score. And of course, you know, unless they're a complete genius and get a perfect score right from the beginning, I think anybody is able to improve on their base score by 5 or 10 points just through practice. That's kind of a bold statement, but I do think it's true.
Yeah,
So having
the
said that,
statistics would disagree with you. They actually, I wish I had the information in front of me. I left my LSAT book, one of my LSAT books that has the information, but I think it's something like you can, like 1% of people like improve their score or something. And I don't know how true that. I don't know. Never mind that fact because I don't know. It's not very useful, and I don't have the information in front of me. I don't know how they phrased it.
well, I do know that people don't typically improve their score by more than 3 points. 3 points is sort of that magical, you know, if you're looking for 3 points, you might be able to do it. If you're looking for 5 to 10 points, usually, you know, the experts say don't try. Although I don't know that I agree with that, because having taken an LSAT, a timed LSAT myself, any number of times, I've shot a 148 and I've shot a 168. And I've shot a 168 with some regularity. So, I mean, there's a 20-point difference there in scores. And, you know, it had a lot to do with my mindset at the time, just random luck on the types of questions I was being asked, how much sleep I got. So I really do think that there is a lot of room to work there, having seen both ends of the spectrum of a low average score to, you know, a very good score. Or at least for me, I think a 168 is a very good score. For some people, that might be an average score. But, I mean, would you agree with that, having taken the test a multitude of times in practice, Nick, that there is some variance in your score?
Yeah, I've probably taken about 20 practice LSATs, and I would definitely say, yeah, I've shot as low as I think it was a 149. I think I shot as high as a 164. So that's kind of my range. It was pretty frustrating, you know, when but you just got to stay with it. And like Mike said, there's a lot of variables that go into how well you're gonna do, how fast you're gonna read. Because sometimes, you know, my mind would just be slow. I'd be reading something 2 or 3 times, and I'm going, "What's going on?" And then other times, you know, I'd fly through 4, 5, 6 questions without even, you know, very, very quickly, you know, and not really recognizing it. But yeah, I would definitely agree. There is a ton of variation in the way, and that's one of the things that I think you have to overcome in terms of like when you're finally going to take the test, because you may be like, well, you know, I've shot this. This is my best score. I've shot this. This is my worst. And I've kind of been flip-flopping, and I haven't been really consistent. And you just have to go in there and find your authentic swing, as to pull a Bagger Vance quote.
We actually have this quote here, and we have a guest caller. I think we're going to take that first. Yeah, we'll go ahead and do that now.
Yeah,
Caller, welcome to the show.
So that's all you guys could score?
Yeah,
that's
I'm
what we
afraid of
got,
one two.
Joe. What?
No, I did a 184, and that was on my
Oh,
third
yeah.
try. Yeah, for Georgetown.
Was that back? Because there used to be a different grading scale. Are you serious? Because
Nah, I'm
they had.
kidding. I never took the LSATs.
All right. Because I think they used to score from 100 to 200, so I was like, maybe he did do that.
Well, I'm sure somebody has, but probably the one who probably did very well was probably not very good in the courtroom. For
Right.
example.
Yeah. We're
That's
talking about the
actually.
Rain Man type person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did okay, yeah, but did you win any cases? No, I haven't, but I'm bright.
Definitely don't know the price of gas. Definitely don't know.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point, Joe, in that, you know, we put so much weight into these tests, and what reality do they have when you're actually out there in the practice of whatever the test is trying to do? You know, somebody who scores really well in their MCATs, I would like to think that they're a good doctor, but I don't really know. Or maybe they are a really good doctor, but they can't talk to patients for anything, you know.
Well, yeah, that's almost like an acquired taste. They they probably end up being very obnoxious and arrogant because they have too many patients saying, "Well, thank you, doctor, even though you killed my mother and my father."
Right.
You know, and again, you have to have intelligence to pass any kind of really institutionalized type of standardized exam. But to really succeed as a lawyer, as a criminal lawyer, my opinion is that you really have to know what you're doing in front of a jury. You have to know the law, how to apply it, how not to piss off the judge, how to influence the jury's mindsets. That doesn't come with the LSAT, I'm presuming.
No, I'd absolutely agree. I've heard it said myself, you know, from instructors and whatnot, the key to success in the courtroom, at least in regards to a jury, is being able to tell a good story.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds kind of sad, you know, that has anything to do with who wins and who loses. But the fact of the matter is, very often, the jury will find for the person they identify with the most. So they'll find for the group that, you know, seems the most like them or the most honest or the most truthful,
mm-hmm.
even if it has nothing to do with their legal arguments.
Yeah.
So I think Joe is absolutely right there. And it raises the question, you know, Nick asked, what is this test worth? I mean, if I do great on this test, should I think well of myself? If I do poorly on this test, should I think poorly of myself? What do you guys think?
I definitely don't think so. I don't think that the test really informs on how well you'll be in the courtroom or how successful you'll be in anything that you do. The only thing that I think it does predict is just what kind of law schools you're going to be able to get into. And that's just the
right.
reality of the situation. But I don't think it reflects anything on, you know, your ability to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm over 40, let's say I wanted to change careers, and I did poorly, I wouldn't care because I would know that my skill, hopefully, would be that of talking to jurors inside the courtroom, preparing the case to make it easy for the jurors to digest and to be influenced by. But if I were 21, 22, 23, and if I did poorly, I would probably think my career would be over.
Right. I know.
Well,
I definitely looked at the test. Go ahead.
I was just going to disagree with Joe and say I wouldn't think the career would be over, but I would definitely be thinking, is this what I want to do? You know,
mm-hmm.
I think if you have that defined and you know that you want to do it and you're willing to work your butt off to get there, then I think you go for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you on that. But I think if you fail, if you're young and if you've been taught, well, grades make the man. Then you're thinking, oh, God, you know, I might have to take this. Because I think, isn't it, I know the financial exam, if you fail it three times, it's not a problem. law school exam, if you fail it twice or so, nobody should really condemn themselves. But let's say you fail it the third time, then you're thinking, oh, God, I suck, you know. And if you
right.
you know, if you really want to do it, if you really want to get ahead, if you really want to get the degree and maybe follow in your father's footsteps, yeah, you'll do it, but along the way, your self-esteem is kind of damaged.
Sure,
well,
sure.
I think on average the person would be, you know, but I like to imagine that there's some idealistic, enlightened 20-year-old that would just not be damaged at all, but totally psyched the whole way through. But maybe I'm being a little idealistic there.
Yeah, I was anything but psyched while I was taking the LSAT. Definitely not psyched.
Yeah.
We actually have another. Go ahead.
Well, we can wait. I can wait for the other caller. I don't like to keep people
okay.
waiting.
Okay, we'll go ahead and see what the other caller has to say, but we'll keep you on the line, Joe.
Okay.
Caller, welcome to the show.
Hello, am I the other caller?
You are the other caller, area code 517, it is you.
Hi, Joe, how are you? Merry Christmas, happy holidays, happy Kwanzaa.
Yeah, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Kwanzaa, Ramadan, or whatever it is, and all of that.
Ramadan.
Which
is over, actually. But I just wanted to follow up on this conversation about the relevance of the LSAT to the practice of law. And actually, like, before we get to the practice of law, what is the relevance of the LSAT to law school? Having taken the LSAT, gone to law school, and taking the bar exam, that's where I'm coming from. But I find it so fascinating. You know, I took the LSAT several years ago. I barely remember it. It took me 5 years to finish law school, so I guess I took it like 7 years ago. But, you know, 75% of it is on analytical reasoning, with 25% on reading comprehension, which also involves a component of critical thinking. And as you said at one part in the show, when you're talking about the logic games, we're talking about, you know, sort of deductive reasoning, and there is a right answer. And one thing that's so fascinating to me hearing this, and now having gone to law school and finished it, seeing the complete disconnect, A, between the LSAT and law school, B, between law school and the bar exam, and finally, you know, between the bar exam and actual practice. I mean, there's a complete disconnect that's actually, you know, I can't, it's so messed up that I can't believe that it is by accident. I mean, but in law school, what is the although critical thinking is important, the most important kind of critical thinking is analogical reasoning. So the ability to see what's called a fact pattern. Nick, you're referring to the stimulus, those paragraph that you read. Well, in law school, you read cases, and the cases have what's called a fact pattern. And what the real skill in, at least like the analytical skill, I mean, you're also talking, Joe, about the emotional intelligence that can be practiced in the courtroom. That is absolutely essential as well when you're in front of a jury. A lot of law that's practiced is not in front of a jury. But in any case, it's being able to read, you know, what's called a fact pattern, and then read a similar fact pattern, and then distinguish by pointing out bad analogy, good analogy, what have you. But it's really analogical reasoning that's going on. So a good lawyer will be able to look at his or her client's fact pattern and then have a good idea of what the opposition is going to come up with, okay, well, and then be able to distinguish the fact patterns that the other side is using to assimilate. So I don't know if I'm making sense, but sure, you're talking about criminal law. And so this is done in criminal, it's done in every part of law, because the whole thing is, the question is this person, you know, falling under certain categories? And the way to argue for that is to say this case is either similar to other cases which are in your favor, okay, or different from cases which are against you. So this part of distinguishing, that's the real skill that's going on. I just wanted to say that, A, to, you know, put it out there, and B, to also say, indeed, there is a huge disconnect between all of these exams. And I don't believe at all that they have anything to do with success in the courtroom or success in law school, nor do I believe that where you go to law school has anything to do with success. For example, Mark Dreyer, who he's sort of like a mini Bernie Madoff character, went to Harvard Law School, and if you don't know about him, you can Google him, Mark Dreyer, M-A-R-C-D-R-I-E-R, 60 Minutes did a piece on him. And he built a law firm, Harvard Law educated, but he also like built a law firm on hundreds of lies. I'm not going to go into what he did, but he's now in federal prison for the rest of his life. Similarly, very good lawyers have gone to Tier 3 law schools. So I'm just saying it's a mistake for us to think that any of these markers that other parties have set up mean anything definitive for one's success, either in law school or in the real world when one's finally practicing, period. That's all I have to say.
Awesome.
Sure. Yeah, well, I'm completely good with that. On the other hand, let me just play devil's advocate a little bit. Isn't it true that the starting income of a graduate from a Tier 1 law school is completely different from the starting income of a graduate of a Tier 3 law school?
No, first of all, I mean, it depends what you're doing, why you're going to law school. So one could go to Harvard Law and want to do legal aid, you know, in which case, you know, you may be making a smaller salary than someone who's just graduated from Cooley and who's doing personal injury. I mean, so the other thing I want to say is you know, why are you going to law school and what kind of law do you want to go into? There's a lot of people who graduate from top-tier law schools who want to work for, the legal aid, pro bono public service sector, and they're not doing it for the money. And, you know, I recently watched Miracle on 34th Street, which involves a lawyer defending Santa Claus. And at one point in the movie, he's having a conversation with the woman that he's interested in, and she's railing on him because he's quit his prestigious law job to defend Santa Claus. Sorry, Kris Kringle. I'm not using his proper name. But she's like, what are you doing, throwing your career away? You know, you're not going to have any more jobs and blah, 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 and you're not going to be successful. And he says, well, I guess we have different definitions of success. So with that statistic, I would say, you know, are you doing it for the money? Why are we bringing that up? So I wouldn't say that marks a successful lawyer.
Well, I agree with you in theory. I'm simply saying that I think society definitely places a leg up for the Yale graduates, for the Harvard graduates, as opposed to the Cooley graduates, you know, who, if they don't graduate top 10% in their class, are probably going to need to scramble a little bit for that first job.
And without having any experience within law, I'd have to agree with you. Anybody who has a Harvard moniker, Yale and Princeton, automatically makes a good impression, automatically makes people think that they're more intelligent than the average graduate.
Dumb enough to believe it.
Well, I agree.
It's more of a show than it is anything. But I think the difference in what kind of I think me and Hope are saying between you guys is that it really doesn't seem to actually matter. opposed to what society says and what actually matters. I think that's where we're disconnected.
My question, though, is that the guy coming out of law school, if he's going to apply for a position, let's say there's a law firm that has 500 clients, 500 lawyers, and they're trying to make a name for themselves, I think they would be more inclined to hire from Harvard rather than... You guys mentioned Cooley, which I never heard of, but let's say I would think that a graduate from Harvard would show them more potential in their minds, and they would actually pay a higher starting salary for him than Cooley.
I agree with that statement, yeah. Not saying it's right, though, or that it makes much sense, but yeah.
I don't want to say anything anymore. You guys have 10 minutes left, so...
And if give you the floor, that'd be 9 minutes of it.
All right, I'm just going to be quiet. Continue
on. Right, Hope.
I'm not Hope, I'm Kris Kringle.
That's right, old Patty Duke or, yeah.
All right, sorry. That's all I wanted to say, but I'll stay on the line just in case.
Okay, go ahead. As long as we're off topic, I always had this question in my head. I've been doing a lot of looking, and of course I'm applying to law schools right now for the fall semester, and I've been looking at, you know, admissions numbers or standards at different law schools, and looking at Harvard or Yale, you know, if you haven't shot a 170 on the LSAT, or your, you know, mom or dad's last name isn't Bush or something like that, your chances of getting into Harvard or Yale are basically non-existent. But I've wondered to myself, you know, how is it that we have so many, pardon my, you know, vulgar language, stupid politicians who have attended all these Ivy League schools when their admission standards require like a 170 to even apply? How does that work? I mean, let's be serious. George Bush did not shoot a 170 on the LSAT. For all my talking about it being a learnable test, I just think he's one gentleman who probably didn't make the cut.
I'm pretty sure that George Bush did not go to law school and that he has an MBA, not a JD.
Oh, no, well, there you have it. That could be it.
But it still applies to him because he's pretty much of a dummy, and I'm sure his family paid to get him.
Disparage the intelligence of our leaders, but I want to say that I know Harvard and Yale are private institutions, and they can basically have whatever admissions policies they want that are, of course, harmonious with states, their state's laws. But I do know that there's something called legacy that's used at Ivy League schools. So it is, if you're a father or mother or, in some cases, great-grandfather, I mean, if you have a family member that has gone to the school, that is going to give you an additional point or several points on your admissions final tally sheet. So that plays a role, whether or not there's been someone in your family who has gone. You guys were talking about before, law schools look at the colleges that you went to. Same thing happens with these top-tier law schools. Well, if you have graduated from, you know, Harvard itself or a good school, that also counts towards you. So what I'm saying, and also geographic, sometimes they look at geographic diversity. There are a whole slew of factors that go into the admissions decision that are non-academic in law schools, and that's all I want to say. So it's not like they're just looking at your LSAT, especially the private ones. Because there's sure. So many people who have that LSAT, quite frankly,
right.
From all over the world. I looked at one statistic once for Columbia, and I think, you know, they have like something like 300 slots and 6,000 applicants, 2,500 of which have like the right LSAT score. So they have to look at other things if, for example, they're looking for a diverse class and so forth, and if they want people from all over the world or what have you. They can't just look at that. And sometimes
sure.
That makes all the difference.
Right.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead, Mike.
Well, I thought we might shift gears here. Before the show, Nick, you were kind of talking about how you felt about these scores and what effect they had on determining our futures. Do you want to expound on that some more, maybe bring that up now? As I recall it, the conversation we had before the show was something about how all these standardized tests sort of lead to an elitist attitude. You got anything
yeah,
there?
Well, and I think that we've basically gone over that is that you know, these tests don't necessarily, in actuality, don't represent the elite. Let's say you score in the 99th percentile and the LSAT. That doesn't have any actual, I guess, inherent goodness to it, or it's going to make you elite over other people in the way the world is and how that will be used. Just because you shoot that doesn't mean that. But that said, as we noted, the top schools only take the top scores on the LSAT, and
right.
The name alone sells the person. So if I went to Harvard Law, I'm immediately looked at in the eyes of those who are hiring as somebody who's elite. And so that's just where our society finds itself. That said, I was going to kind of plays into this too, is I was going to say, you know, what is, you know, when you're taking the LSAT, we kind of discuss different, you know, let's say you do bad, let's say you do well, kind of what does that mean? And I think what really matters in terms of the individual, and I could be just being idealistic here, but I don't know, to quote Tal Ben-Shahar, to be idealistic is to be realistic. That if you study hard for the test and you give it your all and you did all that you could and you go to test day and you take the test and you it's out there on the table. That's it is what it is. And you know that you did well, like in terms of preparing for it, in terms of like the work ethic you had, the habits you put into it, the time, whatever, you know, you feel you did an excellent job. I think that's where the meaningfulness of that test comes from, you know, is just knowing that you put the work in and stuff like that.
But, can I counter that?
Sure.
Please.
Why is that funny?
That's all I have to say.
Joe.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I as a follower of Tal Ben-Shahar and one who preaches that same mantra, you know, when I took the bar exam, I studied really, really hard. There's no way I could have studied harder. Impossible. Impossible, and I knew that. And when I was driving home from the bar exam, I said to myself, it doesn't matter, you know, and if I failed. Actually, Joe, I took it with somebody who was, it was his fourth time taking it,
mm-hmm.
and he passed on that fourth time.
Mm-hmm.
And And I remember saying to my, and he was actually a former student of mine, and I said to myself, you know what, I'd be cool if he passes and I fail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as Nick and Mike know, I did fail by half a point, and I appeal. I had to write an appeal, and I won my appeal.
Yeah,
but I can tell you that when I got that letter, Nick, I wasn't thinking I'm living the dream or anything like that. So, you know, it could be. I right after the test, I felt that way, but it was, you know, several months.
Right,
after.
And
take the test in July, and I got that letter in October. I'm just pointing that out. But
yeah.
Then
and
talking
I,
to, you know, people, put the perspective back, but it was still extremely painful. And I don't think I've gotten over it, even though I have passed the bar, you know. I'm licensed,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I've gotten over it.
Well, you know, and I don't think
yeah.
it's an unusual experience. I think a lot of people who do put in a lot of work, into their intellectual endeavors, and they don't come up to the standards that they want, they feel that they failed. I think it's natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told people, because I have never applied for law school, but I said, well, with college, it makes you feel good. But the reality of it is that about a week goes by after you graduate and you forget 95% of whatever the hell that you were studying, unless you're going on to be a doctor or to have some sort of really specialized training. Other than that, you do feel good about yourself. You think that those who do graduate from the so-called elite schools are more intelligent than the rest, and some of them are, but when they come out here and they try to apply common sense, it's as though their brain is empty.
So there you have it, words of wisdom from Joe.
I agree, you know, this has been a problem since the Greeks. It's the application that really, you know, gets
mm-hmm.
people. That's the doozy.
I just want to say, I agree with you, Joe, in that you said that, you know, people feel like they failed when they didn't miss their when they don't meet their standard. And I felt
right.
like I failed when I first got my score. I got a 157, and I wanted a 160 or higher, because that's
mm-hmm.
what I was shooting at the time. And so, yeah, it did hurt. But you know what? It was like, at the end of the day, it's like, it is what it is, you know. And I think, I don't know if you said this, but I feel like you did, that after, you know, once you graduate or once you're done with it and further down the line, you're not, that isn't even a part of who, you know, it's not even a part of, it's not negative.
Well, what you've learned doesn't
negative
really,
in your
yeah.
psychological picture, I guess.
Well, what you've learned doesn't apply as much as people think, but in terms of what you're talking about, Nick, psychologically, it does apply, because people do think of themselves according to their experiences and their successes. And when you've strived to accomplish whatever degree that you're looking for, because God knows you've got to put in the homework, you've got to talk to your mentors, you've got to do all kinds of intellectual bullshit just to learn this stuff and to wade through what I call white noise of poorly written textbooks, and then when you graduate and you find out you don't even need this crap, then you feel, okay, good, I've accomplished, I've got my degrees. Yeah.
All right. I can dig that.
You know. But
well, having
say,
only a.
But one thing I wanted to say is that you guys, I hope, I didn't know that you were practicing, but if it doesn't matter in the long run from what school you've graduated, if just as long as your record is like 9-1 when it comes to defending
sure.
your clients.
No, I agree. If you're a hard worker, you do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what matters. And it doesn't really matter. Now, you know, we have like 1 minute left, that's all I'm saying. Do your homework, that's what matters.
All right, having only a minute left, Nick, how do you think we can sum up the show here? If I had to give advice to someone who's about to take the LSAT, I would tell them, start practicing, practice early, practice often, do it for an hour a day, learn the different sections of the test, time yourself early on, because, trust me, there's nothing like sitting down at the test and then panicking when you have 5 minutes left. I promise you, you can't practice for it. It can't be done. So time
yeah,
yourself, practice often. What else, Nick?
Yeah, there's no way to prepare for what it's going to be like on test day. It's, you know, it's a different experience, even if you've taken as many tests as, you know, 20, like around where I'm at. Yeah, can't prepare for that, but you can learn the tests, I think. You know, I think you can definitely improve your score a great deal. So study on, and good luck to those who are listening.
Yep, good luck. If you are about to take it, feel free to get a hold of us. We'd be more than happy to help you out. Ben Ethics Talk. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Have a great night.
Good night.